I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we'll learn more about a program in the city of Spokane that's designed to steer people who are contacted by police away from jail and towards social and mental health services. One goal is to ease overcrowding at the jail. Another is to help people who act out in minor ways get the help they need, rather than an excursion through the criminal justice system. The Community Diversion Unit, or CDU as it's called, pairs officers and mental health professionals in one-on-one teams that go out on regular patrols. The county has a similar pilot program. This program is about the city's project. It's funded for the next 18 months in a roundabout way by the State Department of Social and Health Services. In 2015, a court determined the agency often takes too long to do mental health assessments of people who are arrested, and they sit in jail until their evaluations are completed. So far, the agency has paid dozens of millions of dollars in sanctions and will continue to do so until it can improve its evaluation system enough to satisfy a judge. Frontier applied for a grant for some of that money and received about $640,000. Jan Dobbs and Nate Spearing are here to talk about it. Dobbs is the Chief Operating Officer for Frontier Behavioral Health. Spearing is a patrol sergeant for the Spokane Police Department. So your folks ride in the car with Nate and Nate's team. Is it? Are you there for a full 8 hours or a 10-hour shift?
We work whatever shift the officer works.
Yeah, it's they're scheduled at least 10 hours, you know, and so our officers are working a 10-hour and 40-minute schedule. And when you hash it all out and 5 days in a row and 4 days off, it's the same as working 5/8, but it keeps the officer on the street for that full 10 hours and 40 minutes. So the clinician's in the car essentially that entire time. They attend roll call with us, so they are getting the same information. And we've even had the clinicians at roll call, which is great, say, man, that name sounds familiar. I think that I dealt with them. And they can pull up their own records. And while you're not dealing with a crisis right then, so they're not going to share medical information, they can say, well, this is the last address maybe I had or something like that. So we're able to even kind of facilitate some follow-up type thing and actually head some things off before police just are responding just again for another criminal complaint.
You have a lot of folks riding in. Reporters come in sometimes, elected officials. What's it like to have somebody there for your full shift?
Yeah, and that was the biggest, hurdle for our department. It wasn't the logistics of setting it up and all of that as far as the program goes. It was the initial sell to the officers on the street. An officer's office is their car, and you're taking somebody and you're putting them in the office, and they're there the entire day, and they're probably going to be there the next day. And then it just becomes one of those things where, boy, when I decided I wanted to be a police officer, I didn't realize I was going to always have a partner with me. And so the flip side of that is it didn't take very long at all for the officers to recognize that how much of a time-saving program this really is, and how when you see it work where the clinician is talking with somebody, they're getting them an appointment, that person has a tangible appointment. They know that tomorrow at 10 o'clock they are going to go here and they're going to talk with the therapist. And so that alone can make a difference and set a safety plan in place. And now all of a sudden my officers don't have a whole bunch of paperwork. They don't have a two-hour wait at the emergency room. So it didn't take long at all before they started to see the benefit there.
So we've seen it from the officer's point of view, from the mental health professional's point of view. What's it like to work with a police officer for 10 hours a day?
It's definitely a different experience. It is not something that you go to college for. I think that they find it very interesting, and they really do become a team. And they're there for each other, and they have a like mindset the more that they work with each other. And I think probably they see those opportunities where they can intervene early and they can share resources, information, so that that officer, even if they weren't part of a co-deployed team for that day, if they were by themselves on a shift, they would have some information and some resources that maybe they wouldn't have known about had they not been part of a co-deploy team. So I think it really expands their reach.
Officers will wear a bulletproof vest. Will your MHPs do that as well?
Yes, they do. because they are right there with the officer. They're dispatched to whatever call the officer is dispatched to. So there are various situations that they find themselves in.
We do an orientation training with them, some very specific training as well, to include the approach and why an officer might approach the way that they do. You know, people think about officers are going to respond to my call. We're not the fire department, so we don't show up with the lights going and right up in front of the house and put out the fire. It's the deployments are different. And so we walk through those deployments with our clinicians and why and some very basic things to make sure that they are, you know, tactically aware so that you're not giving away your position and just stuff like that. But at the same time, the officers aren't just allowing them to go on every single call. So this program is a little unique with our department in that the officers are always first responders, and that has to be their primary function. So they can be dispatched to any number of calls, and the clinician's going to be with them. That might be a mundane, non-injury traffic collision. It might be a person with a weapon inside a home. So the clinicians obviously are going to be asked at certain times to remain in the car. And again, like everything, as the more and more you do it, you get used to how each other operates. Just last week, I was on a call with one of our clinicians, and I got there, and she was still in the car just waiting. And she never even asked to exit the car when getting to the call. She just knew this is one of those calls where I just don't do it. And that's now from having been co-deployed, you know, since the first part of July. She just knew.
We're talking with Jan Dobbs from Frontier Behavioral Health and Police Sergeant Nate Spearing. Frontier hired at least two local clinicians to be part of the team. Spearing says the department decided not to assign officers directly to them, as the county does in its program. Instead, he rotates officers through that duty.
What we did is we picked shifts. And so we have a downtown clinician, but you also have a clinician deployed on day shift, starts at 6 a.m., deployed on swing shift, starts at 10 a.m., and now deployed on power shift, starts at 4 p.m. So you're going to have a clinician out in the field from 6 a.m. until 2:40 in the morning. Just a little bit of a gap there during the slower graveyard hours, stereotypically. So the clinician being assigned to the shift, then it's up to the shift sergeant, who is the representative for our community diversion unit, to assign who's going to be deployed with that clinician. And we try to deploy them 2 days in a row just to take the awkwardness off of a new officer every single day. And while I thought, you know, early on in this program that that's going to be really, really important, and it was, it didn't take very long at all before, because the officers respond to calls together all day long, even though they're not riding together. The clinician team is going to be showing up on other officer calls, even if that officer's never ridden with them before. So they get used to them that way, and it did not take long at all before you start having volunteers on the shift go, I would like to have that person ride with me today.
How do you get the most out of the mental health professionals? In other words, if you've got a mental health professional for 10 hours and there are very few calls that are going to require their expertise, is it in some days a waste of money just because you've got things weren't with you that day, you just had the wrong calls, or do you try to somehow switch to where they're needed the most?
Yeah, we do. And that's where the supervisors that are working that shift start to pay attention to things. So take this time of year where it's, you know, snow and you have an 8-vehicle wreck on Maple Street Bridge. Well, there's no point in that clinician being sitting in a car on the Maple Street Bridge for 2.5 hours. Whether that's an officer swings by and picks the clinician up or swings by and swaps out with the unit that's stuck on that incident so that we can keep the clinician available in the field. The reality is the officers are dispatched to these calls, and we can't pick and choose and just keep that one unit available. If I have 11 officers that's assigned to my swing shift team, I'm relying on, and that's my minimum staffing, so I'm relying on those 11 officers to be there and taking calls for service, and that does affect call response time, and I can't let that call response time start to creep up just to keep one of those 11 available for any call that comes out that this clinician could be used at. So it's my responsibility as a shift supervisor to start, you know, making sure that my resources are being doled out appropriately. One of the things that is great about the clinicians is They have their laptops. They have their cell phones as well. It is not uncommon at all to see an officer writing reports and the clinician just as busy as the officer, whether they're documenting things that happened that day or they're referring things to the MCAT team through Frontier Behavioral Health, or just like on Sunday, I was on a different call, making a phone call to one of our clinicians and having her contact jail. We had to take this person in, but he was suicidal as well, and he had some medication requirements. And so she was facilitating, making sure that there wasn't anything dropped in his continuity of care, even though he had to go to jail that day. So yes, our goal is diversion, but they stay busy regardless of where they're at.
So you talk about that. That's a nice transition. What happens to most of the people who your people deal with? Are you able to divert a lot of those people from jail to other treatment? Do you have statistics regarding that?
Yes, we have an 85% diversion rate, which is phenomenal. And we also keep track of people that we are diverting from emergency departments, from jail, from inpatient psychiatric treatment. And the numbers are pretty astounding. You know, the other thing that we're doing when you talk about the use of their time is that we also go to community court because we know that there are people that we are interested in who may be at community court. We are also, we have a relationship with the jail so that we can go into jail to see some individuals because what we'd like to do is meet that individual, let them know that we're there to assist them so that when they leave jail, they know that there's someone on the outside who will help them with resources. So the whole idea is, you know, how do we use the resources within our community so that we can help stabilize these individuals so that they don't end up in jail or they don't end up going to or utilizing more costly levels of care.
Nate, you made reference to time savings. For example, when you were talking to the Law and Justice Council, you were talking about when we go to the emergency department in the hospital, we would have had to sit in the emergency room with the person that you had for hours upon hours. How does this change that?
Our clinicians have obviously an embedded relationship with our emergency rooms as well and can facilitate that. And again, they don't have to be with that officer. They can do that over the phone for another unit. And so several times that's happened and saved the officer's time. I think the biggest in time savings, though, is the actual diversion itself. So if you look at what taking somebody to the ER was, that was kind of the, I don't have another choice. And some of that was the mentality. Some of that is maybe the time of night or another factor that just, well, I know this isn't wrong. So rather than risk just a safety plan and leave this person in the community because maybe I'm not familiar with the resources aren't open, or I don't have the time to do that. So then the hospital might be just the safest way to resolve the issue. The biggest time savings we're seeing is actual making that safety plan in place and not even having to go to the ER. And a safety plan can be anything, but when you have a clinician there able to, again, like the therapist, you know, meeting the next day, the appointment or a med check or getting information on what baseline really is for this person. And now we can see that they aren't too far off a baseline. So maybe we aren't into this mission critical, you know, emergency that we thought we were. And so the clinicians are helping there, which the officers are starting to find and be comfortable with making those safety plans and leaving the person in the community in a safe environment. So you're saving that there. Our sheriff's department operates a program that is similar, but it's funded completely different. So the sheriff's department does receive some funding as well to be able to partially separate a patrol. And he is still responsible for patrol, but Deputy Moman works with a clinician and is deployed with that clinician all the time. So they keep, and they're able to keep the stats where we can't on a particular ER visit. And I want to say he was right at 12 minutes for their ER visits when they have to go. And that is just astounding if 12 minutes to
from the minute you walk in the door to the minute you walk out the door. It's wonderful to have a mental health professional with the officer. Is that mental health professional also available via phone for other officers who might be doing as a consultation at the same time, maybe working the same shift?
You know, and officers talk all the time, whether that's, you know, on the air, hey, give me a call, or you send them a chat message and they have the clinician call. And that's exactly what we did last week when I had the clinician do the med check with the jail and ensure that was going to happen, is I just sent that officer message, will you have your clinician, I called her by name, but will you have her call me at this phone number? And then I just ran her through. So he's doing his call, and I don't recall what it was, but it wasn't, she wasn't being used on the call. And so she, while he was doing his call, called me and we were able to facilitate that. You know, as an example, how that happens, our officers are deployed geographically. So we have a north side crew and we have a south side crew, which includes the downtown core. One of the issues that we have had is if a clinician is riding with a south officer, but you have a north side officer goes, hey, man, I could really use this clinician on my call. So they'll ask radio, hey, do you have the CDU unit available? So that's up to the shift supervisor whether I can afford to send an officer from the south side to the north side, because you are reducing the staffing level on that side of town. It starts to become a logistical issue. If I'm taking a south officer, then the reality is I should take a north officer and send them south for the amount of duration of that call. But maybe my north officers are all tied up because there's a stack of calls waiting. So we got to be careful with that. Kind of our unwritten rule of thumb, if you will, is since I cannot just dedicate and say yes anytime they're wanted, clear them and send them, is if it's going to be one of those tangible things where an officer recognizes, ah, boy, this is one of those situations I really should get somebody involved, because, you know, officers are starting to see how to handle these calls more efficiently by having the clinician with them. So I'm also not getting as calls as often as we were early on, because now I had that clinician with me 2 weeks ago for 2 days in a row. I watched how things operate. I remember that. So I'm putting those things into place myself. So I think you are starting to change and shift just the entire way that officers are working on the street, which is its own benefit. It's outstanding.
So it's kind of like on the job mental health training for them.
Without a doubt. And you know, all of our officers will go through 40 hours of CIT, crisis intervention training. But, you know, in a classroom environment, you can get the information, you can do the reality-based training, you can leave there, you can go on the street, and you can do nothing but burglaries, collisions, and vehicle prowlings, and all, you know, for weeks at a time. And then you come to a mental health crisis, and the few things that you remember might involve hospital visit. And so you know it's not wrong, but all the other stuff you haven't put into practice yet, you know. And so this repetition on the street just reinforces that on a nonstop basis. And you're seeing excellent creativity, communication styles. You're seeing things that are working very efficiently.
So we see how the officers are benefiting from this. What about the mental health professionals who are out? What are they learning through all of this partnership?
I think they're learning how to, in an emergent type of situation or a crisis situation, how to complete an assessment in a timely manner so that they can make decisions about what is really viable here. They get this opportunity to utilize a lot of the resources in our community. Housing is one of the most destabilizing factors for the individuals that we come into contact with. So Frontier has developed some housing resources. Right now we have some agreements with some shelters so that this team on a 24/7 basis can contact a shelter and get someone admitted and get them stabilized. They also have access to our Mobile Community Assertive Team, or MCAT, through Frontier Behavioral Health, so that they can do that immediate assessment, put those resources in place, but then hand it over to a team that will then do the follow-up. And that follow-up may take a day or a week or longer, but there's someone who is engaged with that individual so that no one drops the ball, and we can get that person to the right resource in the right time. So I think that they're really immersed within our community. They have an appreciation for the resources that we have, and that relationship with that officer is paramount. You know, I think out of anything with this project, it's that relationship, that understanding, and that working, you know, working out a crisis together and really sharing what each other knows so that the next time it'll be more efficient, better, better decisions are made, et cetera.
We're with Jan Dobbs from Frontier Behavioral Health and Police Sergeant Nate Spearing. During the first 7 months of this program, they report the community diversion unit teams have responded to about 700 calls. They've diverted about 85% of their contacts away from the jail. Some were sent to hospital emergency rooms, or the teams made arrangements for people to receive other services. Jan Dobbs says the grant that funds this program will run through the rest of this year. Frontier then can apply for another 18 months of funding to continue it, and then another legal settlement in this case will make more money available. Frontier can apply for that too. In addition to the two programs with the policing agencies, Frontier also has a counselor assigned to the Spokane Fire Department.
So it sounds like your program, there is at least a future for the next few years possibility of funding. Beyond that, what about it? Is this something that should be baked into budgets to say this is something that is so valuable that we need to continue doing it? Or is it still one of those things where it's still kind of iffy? It's still, you know, maybe we do, maybe we don't.
I think that the Seattle Foundation has been clear from the beginning that this is funding that you use in your community, see if you can make that difference. But they're also interested in the sustainability of this, so that if the funding were to decrease or go away altogether, can your community sustain this? So I believe that this initial 18 months and the second 18 months is our time to ask that question, is this making a difference? And so far, with the data we've collected, it's making a phenomenal difference. And so we are constantly looking at what other funding sources are there out there, and helping our community to appreciate that if we can divert 85% of the people we have contact with, if we were to cost that out and say those 85% were never diverted, what would that have cost us with our jails, with our hospitals, and with our inpatient psychiatric units?
And Nate, when you go to your superiors and say, they ask you, okay, is this worth the money? What's the case that you make?
So obviously this doesn't have any funding for police bodies. That being said, I have to credit my superiors for how important it is to them already, because they, knowing it doesn't have any funding for bodies, they wanted to make this work. And so from the chief's office on down, it is absolutely important to our department, to the city, and our city administrators as well, backing this program. I think right now, and when I'm hearing on days off, it's story more than anything, more than data, but on days where our clinicians aren't working and officers on the air are forgetting that they're not working on a Saturday and they're asking for them, it absolutely is a necessity in this community. One of the things I can't stress enough is, as a first responder, you are dealing with somebody in their moment of crisis, and that is a critical time for injunction in that person's life. We don't have a lot of follow-up that we are able to do. Our sheriff's department has been able to do that because they are one co-deployed team all the time. But just their stories of the second and the third interaction that they have with folks, and the mindset that that has changed, not just from the law enforcement or the clinician side, but also from the client's side of the house. So the benefit is clear. And again, that's noticed from our city administrators, my command staff, all the way down the line, constantly looking at how can we, you know, continue to have this program benefit the city of Spokane.
Nate Spearing is a patrol sergeant for the Spokane Police Department. Jan Dobbs is the chief operating officer for Frontier Behavioral Health. They were talking about the Community Diversion Unit, a partnership of their two agencies. Tomorrow on the Inland Journal podcast, we'll talk about electric cars. Are they gaining traction among consumers? We'll meet a Kettle Falls man who's been driving one for 3 years, and we'll hear from Avista and the state of Idaho about progress made in expanding electric vehicle charging stations around the region. To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.